Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the VFX show. And this is Alex, of course. And we've got the usual suspects here for the show. Ron Brinkman, where are you, Ron?
I am in Hermosa Beach yet again.
John, where are you? John
LeBrie? I'm in Hermosa Beach.
But you're not, you guys are in Hermosa Beach, but not in the same place in Hermosa Beach, right?
That's correct.
All right. One of these days, you know, you guys could record at the same time. Anyway, also coming in from down under, Mike Seymour. Are you actually in Australia, Mike?
I'm in Australia at least for the next couple of weeks.
Where are you going next?
Well, we decided to have a bit of an FX Guide PhD conference thing, which we're doing in America in about 2.5 weeks.
That sounds great.
Yeah, and no, it'd be good. It's a bit of a, I don't want to call it a retreat, but it's a get-together and put our heads together thing.
Oh, that's fantastic.
No matter how good a virtual company is, it's fun to actually get together every once in a while with a whiteboard.
Where is this? This is in LA?
Oh, no, we decided we'd use the ski fields of the resort in Denver, actually.
Where in Denver?
Ah, nice.
It's called Steamboat.
Steamboat.
Yep.
He says it so casually, like, oh, it's one of these places. I think it's called Steamboat.
Yeah.
I've never been there.
We've heard of that.
Fantastic mountain. Yeah, I went to school out in Colorado.
So. Oh, really? I've never been there.
But I went to school in Colorado as well.
Okay, oh. Well.
I learned to ski at Steamboat.
Well, there you go. See, we're all connected to Steamboat in one way or another.
I should put a little qualifier in there. Colorado is the last school I was thrown out of.
Colorado was the, and for me, Colorado was the last school I quit.
There you go. Okay.
I didn't get thrown out, but I didn't finish. So
I was asked politely to leave.
Yeah. No. I just politely left. I didn't have to ask. No one had to ask. So it was obvious. So we've got this movie, Pan's Labyrinth, and this is. This has been out for a little while, but it's picked up a lot. It's gotten a lot more interest lately because of the Oscars and everything else. And so, Mike, can you give us
nominated for
for
best foreign language film nominated?
Yeah, and I think it has a fairly strong shot at that.
Yeah.
Great thing about the best foreign language in the Oscars is that they've removed the option to have films in a foreign language not from the country that speaks that language, which in a single stroke removed. Two films from contention this year, which would have otherwise... I'm not saying that Pan's Labyrinth doesn't deserve to win, but obviously they would have otherwise been up against Clint Eastwood's Letters from Ujima and also Mel Gibson's epic. So it changed the running a little.
Yeah, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. That was a new rule?
Yeah, I mean, I don't actually think I can remember big American films being done in foreign languages before. Do you guys remember a whole lot of films done like that? But...
No, well, other than the other Mel Gibson movie.
I guess Mel proved that it didn't really hurt the sales.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is an extraordinary thing, really, because, the theory has always been that an American audience would like their stuff. I guess I've always had an objection to the concept of talking down to an audience in the first place, so it's being proven by the fact you can make these films in foreign languages and audiences will still go and see them and appreciate them.
But, I mean, at what point do you call Pan's Labyrinth an American movie? It wasn't a lot of the funding from European sources? Or
well, no, Pan's considered a European film because the directors, most of the funding and it was shot in Europe. So I think that was always relatively safe. I think it's just that, and I'm sort of jumping ahead a bit, but I think Cafe FX, who did the effects, took up position in the film rather than being paid up front cash, and that was obviously a very good investment and a very wise move from the guys at Cafe FX.
Now, what was the budget on the film?
I heard, I don't know this for a fact, I heard it was around like $8 million US, but that's in upfront. I don't think it covers deferments and stuff. Right. I could be wrong. That's just a rumor. It's not fact.
It's amazing in that level.
you definitely have to look at the effects in the context of that low budget for how much they did. And certainly the fact that, you know, one of the producing partners is an effects facility is probably key to getting that much done in that kind of budget.
And I think that in kind of a business end of things, I think we may see more of that. You know, where effects, I think that there's definitely a... I mean, this has been kicked around for a long time, but I think that there's been a lot of companies that would like to get away from just being service houses and become part of the production process.
I don't know too many companies that wouldn't, quite honestly. I mean, part of the problem is, you know, for the people that haven't really been involved in the business side of visual effects, it's hardly a high profit sort of industry. It's cutthroat. You're constantly bidding and underbidding to get work. And, you know, anything that could sort of leverage a payoff at the end. Because, you know, traditionally an effects facility, it's all work for hire. So there's no chance of getting anything more back than what you've bid for. Whereas if you do something like this, there's at least the chance, like you said, you know, that the back end can be something substantial.
Well, the ex-head of ILM went to work at Pixar, right? And he's producer on their next film, I understand. Like, there's definitely interest, I think, in the community in getting into.
Well, and I think that there's, you know, even I was, you know, I was at ILM when they were working on Frankenstein. You know,
what happened with that? What was the story?
It went into. I don't know how much I'm supposed to say, but I'll say whatever I know. you know, I didn't hear anything of this directly from. I think I heard more outside of ILM than inside ILM. You know, the ILM stuff was going exceptionally well. I mean, the tests and everything else were just, you know, gorgeous. And I think that there's a short that I think was, I can't remember the name of it, but it was really based a lot on the technologies that were built up during Frankenstein. And the real problem was the script. And mostly just, it just went through so many rewrites. It became Frankenstein itself. You know, it was just this script that just kept on changing and Universal just kept on. And then Universal went through a purchase and then everything got kind of turned upside down again. And then they were changing, the screenwriters again. And it just, they couldn't make a decision and it just kind of died a slow, painful death. And it was still pretty expensive. I don't remember what it was, but it still cost tens of millions of dollars just because they paid ILM for what it needed to do, you know. So, but that was ILM's experiment. Didn't really work out that well with the idea of producing their own, you know, starting to go towards what Pixar's doing, you know, and creating, you know, their own content. And I don't know whether they're, you know, whether that's still something that's, I haven't talked to anyone there that and heard anything that's still something that they're really looking at. But I know that at the time, a lot of it was dealing with the fact that you need a whole lot of people for Star Wars and not a lot of people between Star Wars. And like, how do you create demand to keep the people on overhead, which nowadays for most of these facilities isn't really happening. You know what I mean? Now the facilities are just letting everybody go, you know, between projects. I mean, I think we're pretty much seeing that system wide now.
Yeah, I think that's still fairly common. I mean, it's a sensible business model because you just can't count on there being work constantly in there. So just about all facilities sort of have a core group of people often under contract, and then they kind of ebb and flow as projects come and go.
Let's face it, I mean, the nature of the work is such that, you know, you have crunch periods before the delivery of the film. The artists are looking to take time off, you know, as something winds down and, you know, run to a monastery or whatever. Between projects and you know, the serious artists actually like to, you know, they're more loyal to projects than they are to facilities. So, I mean, that's not the case with everybody, but it is kind of a nomadic lifestyle. It's part of the attraction of being a visual effects artist.
Well, and I think that one of the things that's interesting is the ones that are being kept now, at least from what I've heard from a variety of facilities, are actually not the ones that are, you know, we used to hear over and over again about these specialists. You know, we're looking for, you know, specialists as match movers or whatever, but the ones that seem to be being kept are the ones that are rounded. All right, they can do match moving and some roto and some compositing. There's very few people that can do that well, but those are the ones that they're kind of keeping on staff because they can kind of solve lots of problems depending on how they're coming in. You know, now, obviously, if they have something really, really hard, they're going to have to bring in specialists that handle it. And when they ramp up, they're looking for specialists. But
yeah, it's the core guys that are going to do your, you know, your 911 work.
Right.
And that's the stuff that falls into your lap, right? Suddenly, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done for something that's, you know, got a hard chip date. And they're going to go out to see who's got capacity to take it on. And yeah, you're right. It's going to be those guys that have core skills.
And it seemed like a lot of the folks that have been let go from a lot of these facilities were the ones that were really, really good at match moving or really, really good at roto and didn't have any interest in learning anything else.
But to a certain extent, they're not really let go because they're actually hired on a contract basis. I think that's a big difference as well, because there's the expectation. If you're hired at a company and then made redundant, it's pretty crappy. But if you know you've got a 6-month or 9-month gig, then you kind of build your lifestyle around it, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah, they did let them go. I mean, what happened? I mean, it used to be just, I mean, when I worked at ILM, it was a 3-year contract.
Yeah, no, but I think these days, like, from all the freelancers I know on features, most people get hired on a contract with the expectation that they will leave at the end.
Right.
Which obviously makes it a nightmare if the project runs long and you've got people with double bookings.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and then you get the problem with not keeping people on overhead is dealing with, you know, you suddenly need a lot of roto and suddenly everybody's looking for roto at the same time and suddenly you don't have anybody. You know, and that's been, I know that roto specifically has become a real tight issue in a lot of different facilities just because directors are getting, and I think this is something that I think we saw a little bit with this movie, is directors are becoming more of, they don't want to put green screen everywhere. You know, they just want to shoot it and they want to, you know, people to sort it out. And our tools have gotten good enough that we can do it. It's just that it's a very painful, it's just not painful, but labor intensive.
It's labor intensive, yeah.
Yeah, so.
But it's funny, the issues are kind of related, the two things we're talking about here, which is potential participation in upside and, you know, the sort of nomadic nature of artists. And that's that, you know, the project where it tends to get distributed through, you know, between quite a few houses. It's a, you know, there's bidding wars going on to get large projects in. You never know when you're going to land something. And because of that, no facility, at least in the West, has really emerged as a sort of dominant, I have to have it sort of player. I mean, you could argue that ILM occupies that position, you know, possibly Sony, maybe Weta. But really, few of them have the power to demand upside. I believe that ILM still retains that power. I believe actually that ILM's got a tiny bit of upside in Pirates of the Caribbean. But Cafe FX, I think, has got kind of a perfect storm of a situation here because I've been, strangely enough, thinking quite a lot about this lately. Even though there's a tradition in Hollywood of post-production service houses, whether they're sound stages or, you know, sound guys, whatever, possibly getting a piece of upside. It's never really translated to the visual effects business. But in emerging markets, in emerging film markets, there's no tradition. And so if you become a dominant visual effects player in an emerging market, there's an opportunity for you to say that you want to have to pick and choose interesting domestic projects and to say you want to have upside.
Well, and I think that in the future, especially as films become more competitive, the film market becomes more competitive. And I think it's becoming very competitive and I guess more bluntly risky for producers to make their films. That starts to, when people want to see lots of effects and the budgets need to get smaller and smaller and smaller because you just don't know which films are going to do well. In a lot of ways, if you can find facilities willing to do some stuff for back end, it also greatly lowers the risk of the film.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think that that's going to be something that I think is going to continue to open up opportunities for visual effects firms to get themselves kind of into this position and visual effects firms first. But I think that there's also an opportunity as this starts to move down the path for visual effects artists to be looking at the same thing. I know in the Pixel Corps, that's a big conversation.
Sure.
being willing to do the work for not much upfront, you know, or, you know, some upfront maybe, but not the whole thing, knowing that if the film does well, you're going to have an upside. And I think that you might get better work as well. It's not only less expensive, but the artists know that, you know, they're part of, it's not just a job. It's, you know, a great film and their great shots are what make it happen.
Yeah. I think Cafe, is that 8 million, Mike? Is that total budget or FX budget?
No, that was, okay. So as I said, not a fact that I got from any, I haven't got directly from them, but I understand that was the budget. But I don't think that may include the deferred payments. So, for example, I don't know what the effects budget would be, but it might be on top of that, and that was a deferred payment. That's just what I heard, you know, talking to people around the traps, because we were researching a story for FX Guide. And the thing I wanted to point out is that I think Cafe FX has been really clever for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because I've admired their work for a while, and, you know, they're part of that computer cafe company that also has the Syndicate, and the Syndicate's done some amazingly cool commercials work, like the British Telecom thing they did a couple of years ago. But not only did they get the creative freedom, Alex, that you're referring to in terms of, you know, being able to work outside the US system for a bunch of funding things, but talking to the guys when they were making the film, they had no studio involvement. It was like, you know, literally they said, in one occasion it was like, you know, it was literally down to the VFX supervisor, the producer and the director standing on set going, if it's cool, we'll do it. And that was the only decision-making process needed. There just was no, you know, series of studio execs and meetings and clients to go through. It was just that simple. So they had tremendous...
I think kind of the only way you can make a low-budget movie like that and get a good movie is if you cut out all this. I mean, part of making a movie on a budget is not having too many people making decisions, so you can move quickly and sensibly and not get caught up in a lot of discussion, I think.
Well,
I know that Guillermo, I read somewhere that, you know, I mean, obviously the guy can do big, big movies. I mean, you know, Hellboy and some of the Blade stuff that he's done. And, you know, he said it's a very conscious decision that he's made that he's going to want to bounce back and forth between the two, that there's so much reward coming from doing a small movie where you really are much more master of your own destiny. And even if you don't have quite the same budget to work with, you know, it's a much more personal experience.
Yeah, I think that that's the cost of money. You know, that's always, you know, when you do a big film, there's just an enormous amount of stuff that you're going to have to deal with, you know, a lot of red tape that makes it a lot more expensive. And I think that finding these kind of out of the box ways of solving filmmaking is something that Hollywood's going to need to pay a lot of attention to anyway. You know, it's very forward thinking, I think, the way they built this one, but I think that we're going to see, you know, a lot more of that because people won't have a choice. And there you have it.
Of course, it is still a risk. I mean,
it's a risk on Cafe FX, on Cafe FX side. I mean, the thing is that you're still, I mean, while Cafe FX may be getting a back end, they're still paying their employees every month, you know. Yep. And so doing now, you know, 6 months of work for somebody is laying themselves out pretty far, you know. So that's there's still a risk somewhere, you know. So it's that still has to be always taken into account. How many shots there were? How many shots were there in the entire
300.
Film? 300.
They were shooting for about 5 months in Europe, and then they came back. They did 300 shots in about 5 months.
Do you know how big the crew was for the that worked on this on the project?
I don't have a head count on the crew at Cafe FX. No.
Okay. So they.
But they're not a huge facility, so.
Yeah.
I can't imagine it was that big of a crew.
Yeah. And so they and they really, it looked like that, you know, they started out, you know, looking at, and actually the article, I, you know, and this is not just because Mike's on the show, but the article that's the most detailed I found was probably the FX Guide coverage of the piece. A really, really good article.
Thanks.
And it looks like they kind of started with, you know, the idea of doing some stuff practically or with animatronics and kind of slowly kept on moving back to just doing total CG.
Yeah, I mean, which is
the story you hear constantly these days, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, it's we've heard that time and time again now. Because the same thing happened on Children of Men with the baby, right?
Yeah, and it seems like I think the two big things to me, it seems like, is that when global illumination really became the norm and subsurface scattering really became the norm, you started getting into this thing where you just have a lot of freedom, you know, to create something that looks totally photoreal without, you know, paying usually that rendering price where it just didn't work. You know, and I think that, you know, where you start, you know, I think that those are the two things rendering-wise. And then also I think the other thing was just that when match moving became more automated. Because when you think about how many shots now, I mean, one of the big things in this film is that, you know, they get there and they start shooting and you know, the director is doing Steadicam and doing, you know, Technocranes and, you know, pushing this camera all over the place. I mean, you know, it wasn't that long ago when that all had to be reproduced by hand.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think it's a really sensible model. Even if you know that you've got good CG potential on the back end, it's a safety net in some ways because you know you've always got something in the scene. And right. You know, I mean, a lot of these productions too are, you're not quite sure how much time or money you're going to have once you're into post production, and so this way you've got something there on camera. You know it works reasonably well, and then if it turns out that you've got the time and the budget to replace it with CG, that the incremental cost may not be that high. But if, you know, for something happens and you don't have that, you don't you're not left with nothing. You're just left with a decent animatronic.
Plus, if you're working with children as that were in this film, it must be incredibly, you know, beneficial to have something on set to get eye lines.
Yeah, something real they can react to. Yeah.
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 Absolutely. So, and the big, you know, the big effects, of course, were the one that we saw a lot of course, were Pan's legs. So Pan was pretty much, for the most part, the upper body was mostly physical, except for, I guess, the eyes.
Yeah, I mean, the upper body, there was an actor just sort of doing the work, and they sort of had the suit on, effectively. But the legs, to be jointed the way they were, was a trick. And we got a couple of photos of that from the Cafe FX guys, which we posted on the site to show how that worked. And when I was speaking to them, I was expecting them to say that, you know, yeah, we still did a whole lot of work to it. And that wasn't the case. They were like, you know what, that was the performance of the actor. The makeup was really good. We removed the bits that weren't meant to be there and left it alone. And I think Tom Williamson was responsible for that. But anyway, I think they did a really good job. And And also, interestingly, for me anyway, because I kind of got used to people going, yeah, well, we you know, render in Maya and then we composite in Shake, and it's a really standard pipeline. These right. guys were using a lot of stuff that isn't necessarily the norm. For example, they were using Lightwave, they were using F Prime, and they were using Fusion for their compositing. So that was also interesting, I thought.
Yeah, no, I very interesting. The I mean, but although, you know, Lightwave, you know, while not probably used as much anymore, it does has definitely had a history of great rendering tools and great some great, you know, character work.
Have you used F Prime?
I have never used F Prime. Have any of you guys used it?
No.
That is a rendering plugin, or it's its own renderer?
It's a plugin for Lightwave that Steve Worley wrote, and it's a really good hard object renderer. Now, I say that, I haven't used it, but they just couldn't speak more highly of it. They just thought it was brilliant, and they'd love it to be a plug-in to just every other 3D package. But they were really raving about it, and I was wondering if anyone had used it, because it hadn't been on my radar.
And I guess that
used... Was used, like, the stick creature in the Pixies? That was what was...
Mainly that, I think, they used it for the throne room scene at the end, you know, the big... So the hard object stuff, I think, is where it really came into play more than in the character animation stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, and which I thought it was fairly well done. I mean, so the entire end was really just a big green screen.
Yeah.
At the very end with the throne room. I mean, that was all, you know, there was really no set.
It was like a floor.
Yeah, it looked very good, and I mean, you know, wonderfully art directed too, but that felt very real to me.
Ironically, I thought that the part that when I looked at the plates on FX Guide, what I thought was funny was the physical. There was some practical elements there, you know, of her walking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And of the things when I saw the film, when I looked at it, I was like, oh, I think that's a big CG set because I think it's too. It looked too clean in the middle, you know, where she was walking up. So I actually
that was the real stuff.
That was the real stuff. So I got. I went the. I mean, I assume I just made the assumption that the whole thing was CG. But what was catching my eye was I just didn't feel like there were any scratches. There was no nothing on. It's a really, really clean set. And of course, I was wrong.
It was pretty shots, though, weren't they? I mean, they're just literally,
yeah,
pretty. Like they were well art directed, well put together. I think it was they got a guy called Robert Stromberg in, I think, to do the design kind of stuff on it. Mm-hmm. And the Cafe FX guys really praised him for really pulling that together. That was basically just him and the 3D lead Alex that pulled that whole end sequence together in 2 months, just the two of them.
Wow. Yeah, Rob's a matte painter, you know, going way back, and you know, incredibly. I've worked with him a couple times, and it's
right.
Amazing.
Yeah, the name comes
painter.
Up. Now definitely got a good eye.
What were you gonna say?
I was gonna ask you guys if what do you think of the print you saw? I mean, to me, I understand that in terms of art direction, it was a dark film overall, but the print that I saw, I don't actually seem to be very dark. And
yeah, it was a little muddy.
I seem to be losing a lot of work in the shadows.
Yeah, it felt muddy to me. I think, you know, I think a lot of it is, again, it comes back to the budget. I'm not sure, you know, if you're working on a lower budget, you may just not have budget for doing a lot of lighting. I don't know what kind of... You know, and so then you're forced to use a faster film stock, and you know all these things kind of can conspire. I don't believe this was done as a DI either. I think it went through traditional.
Right.
Nobody has heard of that it went through DI, have they?
No.
Yeah. So you know, I think we may just be starting to get spoiled by the detail in the blacks that you can get with a DI now too.
Right. Hey, to get back to some of the effects there, one of the things I thought was interesting is that I really thought that the frog was an animatronic frog, mostly because I didn't think it looked, I mean, I thought it looked a little too plasticky. Did anyone else think that it was animatronic, or were you pretty sure it was CG?
I don't know if I thought it was animatronic, but it was not the strongest effect in the movie, absolutely. It felt, It felt a bit odd to me in places, yeah.
Like it just seemed very plastic, kind of a plasticky kind of feel. And so I was like, wow, that's a... They're using an animatronic there. I kept on missing the boat on this one. I think I just kept on assuming things based on it. And as it said, it wasn't that I thought that the frog looked great. I just thought that it didn't look like a didn't quite go there. But I can see that they evidently did that with because they get a lot more range of motion. And when you look at what the
frog does, they did have some animatronic frog in there. I don't know if
did they. I thought it sounded like they took it all out. Did they take it all out, Mike?
I don't know if they took it all out. They took most of it out, yeah. I mean, okay. And it's. I guess there's a chance that there was some matching to do with when they weren't taking it out that may have stopped them from taking it to the levels of...
That's true. I mean, that becomes a dilemma that, you know, if you've got a match to something... Yeah. You know, if you're going this route of we've got an animatronic thing in there and we're not sure if it's all going to go away, then you have to kind of try and match it. You can't make the CG look too good because then it won't match and you've got just as much of a problem, and maybe that's what it was.
And they certainly made a full CG toad
denominator issue.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I guess one of the reasons they wanted to do it was to show off their character animation skills. I mean, they said that as a sort of a deliberate, you know, objective as a reason why they were keen to get into this film.
Right.
So I didn't
Which
have a
really
problem.
Showed up good in the fairies, yeah. And you know, I mean that was really where character animation was great, and the insect too, for that matter.
Yeah, the stick. I thought the stick bug was really great.
Yeah,
it was good. You know, that whole opening there, where they're driving into the forest and they come upon the stone. I remember leaning over to my wife, who I saw it with, and saying that it feels just like a Miyazaki film, like an animated film. And
yeah,
you know, the creature comes out, and it even had that kind of sense to it. It was very nice, very lyrical, very very lyrical work. We haven't really talked about it. I thought it was a very impressive film. It's a classic example of how you can, you know, you can if you have a kind of restrained use of your effects to tell your story, you can really put something fantastic up on the screen.
Nope. That's an excellent comparison. I hadn't even thought of the Miyazaki, but yeah, I mean, if you look at this next to something like Spirited Away, and you can see a lot of resonance, and yeah, absolutely.
Now, one of the effects I think that I was most impressed with, I think that when I saw it was really I don't know if I enjoyed watching it, but I just was really watching it deeply was the sewing up of the cheek.
Yeah, that was impressive. I gotta say,
I really thought that was well done.
Yeah, great effect.
no cutting away from that either. That was
That's the whole thing. Is usually we'll hide all of that. You know, we'll hide that with a couple edits. We'll give you a close up where we're really sewing it, and it was a single shot.
I think that came back to
the first time you saw it. You know, when it was just first cut, I thought it was excellent because it came as such a shock to see it.
Right.
And then when you go back to it and he's sewing it up, and it was just excruciating to watch. I mean, everybody in the theater is just, you know, watching it through half, you know, their heads turned halfway away from the screen.
What were you saying, Mike?
Oh, I was going to say that's one of the examples that came up when we were talking with the VFX supervisor, Everett, about just not pulling any punches, that, you know, he was sort of intimated that had it been a fully American film, that wouldn't have got through, but... They were just like, yeah, I'm just going to hang on that shot and I'm just going to not cut away.
Yeah.
And they just didn't. And they, you know, he actually said to us it was totally over the top, but absolutely intentional. He wanted to show this guy sewing up his cheek and he wanted the audience to feel it. So,
He did.
I remember walking in and looking at the billboard and seeing, you know, Pan's Labyrinth R. And I thought to myself, oh, I'm seeing an R-rated children's film.
Right.
That's a bit unusual, and of course, it's intended that they bounce in a very harsh fashion between, you know, the harsh reality of this, you know, Spanish post-war or during the pre-war, pre-war milieu, if you will, and this very lyrical children's world. It was brilliant, brilliantly done. I thought
I was really lucky.
It was really good. I think my wife did say that when she went with me and. She said she had her eyes closed like 20 minutes of the film.
yeah, it was a lot of brutal stuff.
Yeah, it was pretty pretty graphic, but I thought it was very well done.
I was really lucky because I'd just been in Europe and Spain and seen Guernica up close and personal. So it really, you know, that whole sort of Spanish fascist thing with the Nazi links was, I thought they did it. I think they did it well because it wasn't. Obviously, the guy that was the bad guy was the evil guy, but he wasn't a caricature of an evil guy. He wasn't, you know, silly and ridiculous and easily to dismiss. And,
right.
he was creepy.
Anything else that stood out for you guys?
I thought the baby was great. I thought the baby was really good. You know, I mean, it was a short shot, but mm-hmm. thought it looked really nice.
Yeah, no, it was.
And I liked the Mandrake Root character. I thought was really good too.
Yeah, I thought that was really well done. I thought that it was really clean and really really worked. And I think that you really felt the emotion of it. You know, this little root that's actually doing something. So, and I love I really like the guy with the eyes and his hands. I don't have a lot of, you know, posturing about the effects. I thought they were fun, and I thought that it was just really creative.
Yeah, that was cool.
The only nitpicky thing I had, actually, the opening shot of the film, what I believe was the opening shot in the film, when the blood is running up into the girl's nose, it looks CG to me. It was the first thing that looked CG to me that I noticed, and it was very early a shot, and I thought, uh-oh, this can't be good. I'm already picking the CG, but then I got totally caught up in it.
Yeah. Yeah, it didn't look quite right to me, but I couldn't figure out what it was that I didn't like about it. Mm. You know, there, but I'm not sure. I mean, it seemed like it would be a simple enough thing just to play it backwards.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
The guys kind of said that it was a love letter to Ray Harryhausen.
There was a couple of Sky replacements that bugged me once again, but it's minor.
Right. And what were you saying, Mike?
I was just saying the guys kind of said that it was a tribute or a personal kind of thing to Ray Harryhausen, and I was wondering if you guys picked up any of that, because both of the director and the visual effects supervisor, big Ray Harryhausen fans, and he apparently saw it and really liked it, and that just completely, you know, meant everything to those guys. And
interesting. It's just amazing. I'm interested how they connect that to Ray Harryhausen. I mean, like as a tribute to it.
Yeah, because you say Harryhausen, and I always think, sorry, I'm an idiot, but Dancing Skeletons are, you know.
Yeah.
You know, some sort of animatronic kind of thing. And I wouldn't have said that the motion of the bug was animatronic, certainly not the fairies. I don't know.
I think it was the fantastic nature of it. That's the impression I got anyway.
Okay.
The idea of an imagination that, you know, was going wild. And, but yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, really glad that they were glad that he liked it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely.
Exactly. Have any of you guys seen Devil's Backbone?
No.
No.
That was it's almost a companion piece to this, also directed by Guillermo. It was sort of right before he hit it big, and it's a similar kind of thing, you know, same sort of era, and it's a similar kind of mixture of the fantastic, although it's almost more of a mixture of a horror movie, and a wartime setting. But I'd definitely check it out. You know, not a huge number of effects in there, but there are some and really well done. But it's also just a great movie. I'm kind of going back and forth between which one I like better.
Interesting. Yeah, I'll have to definitely check it out. I feel very uncultured. I don't see a lot of that stuff. I'm so busy. So once again, we've got Mike Seymour from FX Guide and FX PhD coming in from Down Under. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks.
And Ron Brinkman from Hermosa Beach, the famous Hermosa Beach. And it's
the place to be.
Digitalcompositing.com, right, Ron?
Yeah.
And John Labrie. Now, John, do you have anything to like promote?
No, I have nothing. There's nothing for me to flog other than, you know, my winning personality. So.
Thanks so much. this is Alex Lindsay, and until next week, keep it real.